Hello and welcome to the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates. Nessel & Associates is an ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. I'm your co-host, Jonathan Donald, the founder of Invert Ventures, a change strategy firm, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Jack Nessel, the founder of Nessel & Associates, and the host of the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast. The ERP Organizational Change Journal seeks to share expertise, insight, and create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success, expanding what we can see so we can act in a more effective way. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community. The primary purpose of this podcast is to discuss, share, and reflect upon effective and efficient ways in which to realize ERP organizational change success. We will discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change. It's our intention for this to be a collaboration tool and resource. We hope that you find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, discover best practices, and explore the human elements and components of ERP organizational change. Our podcast draws on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, practitioner experience of both project successes and project failures. A general review of the themes of ERP and organizational change practice, literature, and research suggests that understanding and critically having an awareness of tactics founded in principle is fundamental to ERP organizational change success. Our podcast will discuss these tactics, explore these approaches, and discover the principles that they are founded upon so that they may prove to be useful in addressing ERP organizational change challenges and risks.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm always so excited and looking forward to fun conversations with you and our guest. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community. As we are a podcast that desires to engage in valuable insight into the world of ERP organizational change success with interviews and roundtable talk, our guests include experts and pioneers in a field, organizational stakeholders, practitioners, and researchers. Our podcast is a platform for those seeking to share, learn, and reflect on ERP organizational change success.
In this episode, we will discuss evidence-based performance improvement with Guy Wallace. Guy is a performance analyst and instructional architect and has been designing and developing performance-based training, instruction, and learning performance support for enterprise learning and their business critical targets since 1979. Guy is the president of Epic, EPPIC Inc. He started Epic in 2002 after 20 years as a consultant and partner in two other small consulting firms, which he had started in 1982. Guy offers performance-based curriculum architecture design for designing T&D maps and paths, instructional information design and development services. Guy's an expert in the design of performance-based training and training and development, T&D, learning paths, and modular instruction. Guy has also authored over 90 articles, 15 books, and close to 4,000 blog posts. He's presented professionally over 110 times. His client lists include Abbott Laboratories, AT&T, Eli Lilly, Ford, General Dynamics, General Motors, HP, the Norfolk Naval Shipyard, NSA, SunTrust, Verizon, Wells Fargo, and several others. Additionally, his work has won awards at AT&T, General Motors, HP, Imperial Oil, and Siemens Building Technologies. In 2010, Guy was the recipient of the ISPI's highest award, honorary life member for contributions to the technology of performance improvement and contributions to the society. Jack, I am really looking forward to this conversation with Guy and getting his insight on learning, training, and development.
Likewise, Jonathan. So in this episode, we will explore effective and efficient learning and development practice. We will examine with Guy several key components to ERP organizational change success, including research-based learning and education principles, L&D practical tips, gap analysis, developing SOPs, standard operating procedures, and more. Guy, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So Guy, it's really a pleasure and an honor to have you join us. Let's dive right in. We all know that there's an effective and efficient L&D, and then there is L&D. So first question is, how would you define effective learning and development? How would you respond to that for our listeners? What does that mean?
Well, it's actually quite simple, I think, and that is it prepares people to perform tasks to produce outputs to stakeholder requirements. And that's all got to be authentic to what's required back on the job for the learners.
So Guy, once we're building effective and efficient L&D, right, what role do you think that research-based principles in play actually have in terms of designing effective and efficient educational learning and training?
Well, it's actually quite critical that we follow what the research and the evidence would guide us to do and to not do. But it's more than just design. It's more than just understanding how we can affect learning in people. It's really what we're focused on in teaching them and creating a learning experience that's authentic to what they require back on the job. So research-based principles are central to whatever we're going to address being done effectively and efficiently. And that's all measured by its ability to impact performance back on the job.
So Guy, I'm really curious here and I want to go a little deeper. It sounds like the real measurement you're setting is how much effect we have on people in an authentic way on how this impacts their job. Can you say a little more about this and how training does in general at meeting that benchmark?
Well, I think we've done a very poor job. I've been in the business now since 1979, so 42 years. And the lament of the gurus, the people that I learned from back in the early days of the late 70s, early 80s, were that we too often focus on topics and not tasks. And I think what we need to do is we need to go beyond tasks. We need to focus on the outputs of tasks. So beginning with the end in mind, we need to understand people are on the jobs to perform tasks, but they're there to produce outputs that are worthy inputs downstream, so to speak. And Tom Gilbert wrote something about this in his 1978 classic book, Human Competence, where he talked about the cult of behaviors. Too often we're focused on topics, or too often we're focused on behaviors in isolation from the performance context and the work products that people are there to produce. So we'll teach a behavior, but we don't provide that context because sometimes you need to be more directive and sometimes you need to be more collaborative, but we don't necessarily always teach those within the context to help the learners understand, you know, what's situationally appropriate in this particular context. Now, I'm overgeneralizing a bit. There's lots of great examples of people doing very effective, very efficient instruction that has had an impact back on the job. But a lot of this goes back to what do we measure? And when you look at what L&D, learning and development, currently measures, the focus is way too often on the activities of learning and not on the results. And what I was taught back in the day, back in 1979, is that we only care about the results,
yeah,
the impact that we have back on the job and whether we're helping people perform better, faster, cheaper, to be simple about it. And then if that's not happening, then we start looking at, did our instruction actually transfer to the job? Yes or no is the answer, and why or why not? And if it didn't transfer, we need to look back at, well, did they master the objectives? Yes or no? And if not, why not? And maybe what we taught, maybe people mastered objectives, but they weren't authentic. They were for somebody else's job, so to speak. And therefore, when they got back to the job, it didn't quite fit. It wasn't an easy segue from learning to performing, and therefore people might have struggled and then just defaulted, reverted back to the way they always used to do things. So, you know, the joke is we're opportunity rich. We have lots of things to work on, but if we have more of a focus on performance back on the job, what outputs do people produce? How do they produce those? What do they need to know in order to be able to do to produce those outputs? Mm-hmm. We'd be much better off. And then we can apply all the science of learning, if you will, and the good practices for designing instructional content that will make it more effective.
So, Guy, I just want to make sure I'm hearing this and point out to our listeners, the key question is, what are we measuring and how does this relate to outputs in whatever context? And once that's our focus, it sounds like, how do we then apply all the great research-based principles to help us achieve that? So it's almost like changing the focus from activity to outcome. Am I capturing
exactly? Yeah, no, I think that that's it. That's an age-old problem. I've heard the gurus lament on the fact that we're too focused on behaviors, on our own behaviors, on other people's behaviors, and we're not really looking at what are the terminal results that we want. What's the end in mind? We're too focused on means.
That's interesting, Guy. Very insightful. And so based on Jonathan's question and your response, I just have two follow-ups here. Based on your answer, it sounds like effective L&D needs to be quite deliberate in its approach. So when it comes to successful L&D, what role does strategic planning play?
Well, I think strategic planning, if I understand what you mean by strategic planning, and that's at the enterprise level, you know, where's the organization going? What are its challenges? What are its opportunities? What are the current state problems that it needs to deal with? That helps us identify what the late Gary Rumler used to call the CBIs, the critical business issues. And if L&D, or back in the day, training and development, T&D, wasn't focused on the critical business issues of the enterprise, we're really not adding as much value that we could be. Now, not everything, of course, is issues and opportunities are not rooted in deficits of knowledge and skill. Most often, it's other kinds of things. So if we understand the strategic planning orientation of our enterprise, and we are aligned with our own strategies and plans in terms of where the organization is trying to go, we can provide support. We can help with through analysis to understand, you know, what's required in the future state and what role does learning have with that. It may be most often in combination with new processes and new tools, new practices, and L&D can help the performers, the learners, master what they need to do to help, you know, move into that future state. So strategic planning is really kind of critical because we can be working on, you know, what's generally called the low-hanging fruit and not going after those things that are critical and would help the organization really leverage its investment and get significant returns on those investments.
So Guy, you mentioned in that response this idea of organizational current state and being able to identify the current gaps, right? The current problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you and I both have a mutual friend and colleague, Dr. Clark, for example, who has done some great work in this idea that you mentioned in question one, actually, around research-based principles and models. In his model, you know, he describes this idea of knowledge, motivation, and organizational factors as being the main components in gap analysis, right? And you have to understand those gaps accurately in order to realize effective organizational change and development. So when it comes to successful learning and development, what would you say as far as what role does organizational culture play just overall and in general?
So there's many things that are meant by organizational culture. The culture of being open to learning, to being open to learning from mistakes and errors, of communicating those more broadly rather than narrowly, to help everybody learn from each other, to learn from the mistakes of others, to learn from the positive lessons learned, to be open and sharing about that, I think is kind of central. A learning culture as one aspect of an overall organizational culture is not all about the consumption of learning and development products and services. It's really beyond that. It's going beyond formal learning to more informal learning. And that's a kind of a continuum where things are very formal and less formal and then somewhat informal and then very informal. The organization's role in that is to help the organization enable all aspects of learning from the most formal to the most informal through recommending and facilitating the use of all sorts of the new tools that are available to people so that they can communicate and share and document, et cetera.
Well said, Guy. I like that. And L&D culture is really embedded, you know, within your organization, both informally and in formal ways. That was very well said.
Guy, I'm really enjoying this conversation. Going off your response to Jack's question, how does that L&D culture in all its forms relate to and play a role in change management and organizational transformation? What role does it have, can it have, or the lack of it prevent in your experience?
Well, I think it has a significant role because when you're changing something, whatever, it may be new to people and they don't understand how to play their role in the new future state that we're evolving to or jumping to. You know, training can play a very critical role. Now, I have a little saying here. Let me share it with you, is that training requests for new hire training should be expected. Training requests for problem solving should be suspected. Too often problems are rooted, and Deming would have said this, you know, 94% of the problems are due to the system. I'm paraphrasing there. Gary Rumler, yeah. Bob Mager, all these gurus said similar things, in that when they're asked to address a problem or the project, the effort is rooted in a problem, too often they're going to find that knowledge and skills aren't the deficit, aren't the big thing that will impact and make the change. It's going to be something else. It could be the culture itself isn't conducive. We're rewarding, you know, bad behavior and punishing good behavior, et cetera. You know, we do crazy things like that. Or that the environment is not conducive. We don't have the right tools and materials out there. We don't provide the right information, or it's out of date, or we're, you know, opportunity rich and taking a look at, and our processes may not even be designed to meet the needs of the stakeholders. And so, you know, we just have issues all over the place, but we shouldn't default initially to let's go fix the humans in the picture, because that's probably it. It most likely isn't. Unless they're new hires and something is brand new or something has changed, there's no reason to, you know, address the situation with content. And then when we do, we have to consider whether or not does the situation, does the performance context demand a memorized response, or would it allow for a reference response? Can we provide job aids or SOPs, that kind of guidance to people to help them perform, or do they really need to have this committed to memory? And then there's a whole bunch of issues with, if that's what the situation demands, how are we going to keep that in Guy's mind, in his conscious knowledge, before it slips to non-conscious knowledge. So we really need to be careful about how we help in organizational changes and play a role in that when necessary, but we can't be just, you know, taking orders for instructional means when that's really not at the root and it's not going to solve anything. So we can play a role here, but I think it's more limited. Change management and the practices of change management are going to have greater impact than learning and development will.
So, Guy, I think this is a fascinating answer, and I want to highlight, I want to confirm something and then highlight it for our listeners. In your answer, what I heard is that there is a tendency to solve any problem coming up with content. And what you've encouraged listeners to do is, if it's a new hire coming in, maybe content's the right answer. But if it's not, and it's a problem-solving issue, then to pause and ask, okay, well, maybe there's a larger context here. Maybe it's systems, maybe it's culture, maybe it's collective behaviors. And is content the right answer for this? So it almost sounds like L&D has a tendency to offer training to any problem, regardless of what is the real challenge and what solution might fix that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. We do a knee-jerk reaction. People ask for training because they don't know what to really ask for, when we would hope and think that perhaps what they really want is performance improvement, you know, something that happened, but they don't know, you know, how to affect that. So they may ask for training, just casually think that, you know, it's that people just don't know what they're doing, or they forgot what they were supposed to do. And so we're going to do refresher training or new training for something. And so I think that we've got to be careful of how we react to those kinds of requests. I remember the late Joe Harless back in 1985, because he wrote about this in 1985 as well, but he was at a conference and he said, I think he was upset with all the pushback. We shouldn't be order takers. We shouldn't be order. We need to push back. And he didn't really like that answer. And he was at the podium in front of everybody, and he said, you know, when somebody comes to you with a training request, don't say in your whiningest voice, are you sure it's a training problem? And, you know, it got a rise out of the audience. They all laughed at that. He said, the appropriate answer is that, yes, I can help you, and I can help you even more if you let me do front-end analysis. Now, that was his term, his phrase, and there's many competing terms and phrases for doing instructional analysis. If we take our clients along on the journey of our effort, they should be able to conclude, as the same time we would, that the issue, the problem or opportunity is rooted in a deficit of knowledge and skills, yes or no, and or these other variables. And so the clients can make conscious decisions. We can help them make conscious decisions about where to make investments to affect performance, to make the improvement, to make the change. And most often, if training, instruction, learning is going to be involved, it's going to be one part of a solution set, and we may need to change the process, we may need to change the tooling, we may need to change the data and information that's made available to the people performing, and then we need to train them on how to deal with all those new and changed things. So training is more, and instruction and learning is more of the tail than it is the dog, and it gets wagged by the dog, that situation.
Wow.
And
yeah.
We can't lead with training, but we shouldn't push back. We should respect people's requests and then do our due diligence. Now, we also need to be cognizant of the fact that we can look at a situation and determine, well, training is not the root cause of this. But you know what? For the people being hired in next week, next month, next year, it will be. So maybe training is part of the future solution, but for the immediately to address this, we may need to make other changes in concert with new instruction.
Guy, I want to pause just for one sec because I'm overwhelmed by the value that I'm getting from that answer from you and all the great quotes. I also want to say it sounds like we need to approach learning and development with a great deal of consciousness around what is the purpose and the outcome we want for the organization and how we can be in support of that. Guy, what a fabulous answer. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree, Guy. I agree with Jonathan. Lots of great quotes in that response. So good stuff. And, you know, I do like what you said about and what Jonathan just reiterated about L&D is really not about knee-jerk reactions, right, to use your words. And we do need to be mindful about how we help in organizational changes. And I think that's really where research-based L&D is incredibly helpful and insightful. I love that response. So, Guy, bear with me for a second, if you would, because I would like to share what I thought was an interesting article with our listeners. So I want to quote from an L&D colleague, an article that I found interesting, and that's from Alex Salas, who's a mutual friend. But he stated that, quote, best practices have common popularity among business people. This is a great way to incite quality work, but it's also easy to see how learning and development, L&D, may have trouble identifying what those best practices consist of. Therefore, in good style learn fashion, here are some great work practices with the hope of enabling anyone, learning professionals or not, to recognize poorly designed training strategies, end quote. And we'll be sure to include a link to this article in our show notes. So that being said, Guy, maybe if you had to pick one of these worst practices and elaborate, we would appreciate it. Are there any of these that you typically see in your practice? And if so, can you just pick one or two to elaborate upon? But allow me just for a second to review these. So the worst practices that Alex had mentioned were, one, don't analyze business needs. Two, avoid learning objectives. Three, design training for people to understand. Four, use training as information delivery. Five, base everything in learning styles. Six, use learning as performance correction. Seven, ask for training acknowledgments. Eight, having SMEs develop training. Nine, rush training development. And lastly, number 10, make instructor-led training your primary method. So Alex goes on to explain how this is his list of worst practices. Any comment on maybe pick one or two of those?
Well, yes, this is a great list. I've known Alex for a number of years here. He's a Navy veteran like I am. And we've bonded over, I guess, the opportunities or the these kinds of issues here. So I appreciate his list. And I would have to take the number one one. Don't analyze business needs. Nowadays, with the advent of e-learning and computer-based training before that, back into the 80s, in fact, it was too easy to just take content and put it online. Now, back before it was all, wide area networks and they were local area networks, the shareability of that was kind of limited. But nowadays, anybody can access just about anything. And what we find is that we've gone for efficiency, or what we think might be efficient, because we reduced our cost to park content online and let people access it. But it doesn't lead to better improvement because we didn't understand the business need in the first place. We didn't understand the processes that people are working in. We too often go for big, broad audiences with some topic that has face validity, but then actually does not have performance validity. And it oftentimes, I've said it this way before, it oftentimes feels like I'm being trained for somebody else's job. So I'm being taught active listening, but it's not for my context. So now I'm expected, after mastering active listening for somebody else's job, to go back to my job and to figure out how to transfer it, how to apply it, how to adjust what I've learned to the variables, the situation that I find myself in. And if I struggle with that, I'm probably just going to drop it. I'm going to forget it and revert back to doing it the way I always did, because I think I've somehow mastered that to some extent. And trying some newfangled way of doing things may be too discomforting, and I may feel less in control of my own destiny, and so I might stop that. But we don't analyze the business needs. We don't understand it well enough. Now, on the other hand, taking a what I would call a process orientation, which is nowadays a workflow orientation, same thing, our problem is that workflows or processes are mostly informal. They are unnamed, they are unmeasured, they are unmanaged. And yet we're supposed to help people learn how to perform in processes or workflows when it's a vague notion and everybody calls it a different thing because they've had to create, because it's not, there's no centralized labeling of that. We've not dissected our processes and says, here's where process A ends and here's where B begins, and also it'll feed C as well. We don't have that configuration well down. Now, part of it is it's a moving target. Things are moving quickly. But that's what makes it difficult for those of us in L&D trying to support people and help them learn how to produce outputs in those processes. But that's our challenge. We need to help people perform back on the job. And so we need to understand that business need. We need to understand what people are expected to do, what they're to produce, what the typical barriers to performance are. What have master performers learned over the years through trial and error? How to avoid problems in the first place and what to do about them in the second place should they be unavoidable? Those are lessons learned that new people need to learn at some point, maybe not on day one, but they need to learn how to perform in those processes. And if we just give them topics and expect that they'll figure out how to do that, well, that's not very effective, and it certainly isn't very efficient. Now, eventually they could figure it out, and it could be ultimately effective, but it was terribly inefficient.
I do want to just mention, and we'll put this in the show notes as well. So Guy is a original, I guess, founder of HTP Treasures. It's a website for evidence-based performance improvement. And there's lots of great resources on HPT, or human performance technology. And I believe even this article that we discussed that Alex had written is even referenced in there. So Guy, we'll be sure to put that in the show notes as well. It's such a great resource, and I recommend to all of our listeners to take a look.
Thank you for that.
In that exchange, you're talking, at least from my perspective, about organizational context. So I want to connect two things we spoke about earlier to this. Can you share with our listeners how important it is to have well-understood learning objectives, both from an L&D perspective? And then I want to encourage you, can you then explain what happens when they're missed in an organizational context? So when you get the learning objective right, but you miss the organizational context, or vice versa? What happens and what's the effect on performance?
Well, the worst thing is that we can be very effective in training people in things that actually don't relate back to what they need back on the job. So we can have learning objectives articulated. We can design instruction that actually, no kidding, gets them to master those learning objectives. But if they don't link to the performance objectives, the authentic performance objectives from back on the job, then we will have missed the proverbial boat. So there's a bunch of issues around learning objectives. One, are they systematically derived from the performance objectives? So if we understood performance and what are the tasks, what are the outputs, how is all of that measured, the outputs are measured, the tasks are measured, what do you need to know to be able to do? If we understood all of that, then we could systematically create, derive from that performance data, that analysis data, what our learning objectives might be. And to me, there's two types of learning objectives. There's performance objectives, and then there's enabling objectives, so two tiers. So ultimately, I got to be able to perform. What do I need to be able to do that? So we could break those things down, and that should provide guidance from the designer, because that's where I do the establishment of learning objectives when I'm in my design effort. That should guide the developer in creating instruction, job aids, and or training that will help the learner then meet those two levels of objectives, learn things, the enablers, so that they can then perform. And then too often when the same objectives that we might give to the developers with their subject matter experts and master performers and others who will help them create the content, we give those same list of objectives to the learner when they start off in the instruction. And we create cognitive overload, and now we've made it impossible for them to actually learn anything from those objectives because we've overwhelmed them with the learning objectives. So when we do learning objectives, there's, you know, two levels of them, if you will. There's one for the developers, the most detailed set of learning objectives, so they know exactly what they've got to produce and how they can measure how well they're meeting the needs. But then what we give to the learners should be high-level articulations of those learning objectives so they understand, why are we here? What are we going to learn? Oh, okay. So we've got to give them some clue as to what they're going to learn and how they're going to learn it without going into all the details that we might have given the development team. And so we have a lot of issues with learning objectives, and you can call them anything you want. But if you don't have I think what Bob Maker called the three-part behavioral objectives is that, you know, they're going to be able to do such and such under such and such conditions as measured by such and such. So those were his three parts, and other people have four-part objectives and all that stuff. But we really need to be able to convey to the people doing development of content, whether that's ourselves, we're articulating learning objectives so that we ourselves can develop the content. It gives us the guidelines and the targets for, you know, what is it we're trying to do? And the goal for that is to avoid, when we do development, including extraneous content that only leads to cognitive overload. And so how do we skinny our content down when we're doing development? The minimum content to meet those learning objectives, which again tie right back to the performance objectives. And again, there's many different kinds of labels and mechanisms we can use to do that, but that's what we need to do.
Guy, these are great points. You know, and I'll tell you from my perspective, I think that exactly what you describe are often missing in ERP organizational change. And I've had the privilege, formally and informally, to review probably hundreds of ERP implementation plans. And often these exact ideas and concepts and tactical approach that you're describing for our listeners is often missing. And in fact, I do want to share here before I ask my next question, you know, I think one of my favorite models for training and training evaluation is the Kirkpatrick model. I know there's others, but you've probably heard of that. But I think, you know, it isn't just about putting information in people's heads, right? So for instance, as the Kirkpatrick model describes, you know, there's four levels of effective learning and transfer of that learning or transfer of that knowledge. And that first level is reaction, which is the degree to which the participants find the training favorable. Level two is learning, the degree to which participants acquire the knowledge. Level three is behavior, the degree to which participants apply the knowledge. And level four is results, and that's the degree to which targeted outcomes occur as a result of that. And I think, you know, regardless of the model, those are four pretty important points to effective learning and transfer of knowledge to meet the end game. You know, as you said, it's not just about putting a training program in front of people and tactical execution of putting information in the heads of people. You got to start with the top, the strategy. And that's why I liked your answer that we ask about, you know, organizational strategy. This is all one. It needs to be considered holistically, right? An effective L&D plan is not just something you deploy. There's a lot to it to make it effective and efficient, which is the topic of this podcast. So guys, that being said, can you maybe share a little more with our listeners on how exactly do you monitor and evaluate learning improvement initiatives? Can you walk us through how you do that exactly, or what's your approach or framework, or do you have like a preferred model or method? Can you shed some more light on that for our listeners?
Yes. So what I learned way back in 1979 again was the Kirkpatrick model. We modified the terminology slightly for our internal target audiences, which was our executive leadership team. So we called level one reaction, and level two was mastery of the learning objectives, and level three was transfer. So that's the behavior that you would see on the job. Did it transfer? Do we see it out there? What's the evidence for that? Level four was ROI, which to us were the results that Kirkpatrick labeled it, and Jack Phillips and Patty Phillips came along later and added a fifth level, ROI. But right. I was always taught that our executives will measure results in terms of ROI, so there you go. We just, you know, called it ROI. And what I was also taught was that we start with that. Did we get the return on investment? Do we see improved performance that's making it somehow through the bottom line? So at whatever level, at a department level, at the enterprise level, are we seeing, you know, revenues are increasing or costs are decreasing because people are more efficient with their time and effective and they're doing things better, faster, and cheaper? So do we see any evidence of that? What were we looking in the first place before we started off? Because, you know, we needed to establish a baseline. Here's what the current numbers are. And then after the training, and then after, you know, after that and after that, you know, do we see an improvement over time in the numbers that we were targeting? And that's the level four. And if we're not getting that, then because the valuation is expensive. So if we look at that in terms of the business metrics that they're already using, that the executives are already familiar with, we need to see those numbers changing in a positive direction. And if they're not, then we could look at, did it transfer? Did what we teach or provide, did it transfer? Did it change behaviors? And we can go look for that. And if it did happen, then we can go back and look at what objectives were mastered, you know, and were those authentic? Now, there's a famous story from back in the 80s. Somebody at NSPI, which is now ISPI, told this story to a conference. And it was a story about training salespeople. So that's a highly measured function.
Yeah.
So we know exactly what, you know, what happens and what happens in this on the West Coast versus the East Coast, et cetera, and all the geographies. And so they had put in some new behavioral based objectives for the sales training, and they taught everybody and it mastered and they measured it and it transferred. And what impact it had on results was that it doubled the sales cycle, which meant it halved the revenues. So, of course, as soon as those numbers became clear that we taught them, they did it, they took it out to the job, they're using it, they're doing it. How wonderful is that? Oh, my goodness, here. It's having the revenues. And, of course, every bonus for every sales executive and the rest of the organization went halve. So that was no good. And so they had to rip all that out and start all over again. They didn't understand. You know, they understood instructional design, but they didn't understand the business and what they were doing and what the impact was going to be to people performing in processes. It was going to take them twice as long to do the sales process following all these great behaviors. So this was the cult of behavior thinking, boy, these are really nifty, neat sound. This is great stuff without considering the impact back out on the job. And so when we measure, we need to be looking at whatever business metrics are there. Now, L&D and training and development before that are infamous for their measurement of what used to be referred to as butts in seats. Now it's butts on sites. Yeah. But basically, these are activity measures, not results measures.
Right.
And so you need to look beyond, you know, how many people have taken this, how many have successfully completed this, but to what end?
Yeah.
So we need to have our eye out there in the business. And quite frankly, if the business isn't measuring already what you're trying to address, how important is it anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're working on something that doesn't actually show up in any business measures, isn't part of a secondary or tertiary set of numbers that rolls up to the big final number that's looked at somebody's balanced scorecard kind of a thing, then are you really working on something that's critical to the business? I mean, surely there are critical business issues that you should be tackling, could be tackling, and that kind of suggests that you are not in alignment with the leadership of your organization. You're not working on the things that keep them up at night. You're not working on their critical business issues. You're working on some, who knows what you're working on then. So the reflection that learning and development people, especially learning and development leadership, because this is an indictment of them, they're not in alignment. They're not having their organization, their functions, their people working on things that will have significant impact, that are part of the current state issues and the future state opportunities of their enterprise.
That's great, Guy. What a great answer and great insight. You know, again, effective L&D is an extremely, I would say, deliberate, intentional, and it needs to be holistic in its approach. That's how I would summarize your great response. And I think often that's missing from a lot of L&D efforts.
Guy, I feel like I need to get you a pulpit because I'm sitting here nodding my head. And your answer basically covered the next question. So I'm going to course correct here a little bit. And I'm going to ask you, clearly there are some common mistakes of not aligning business results with learning and training. So if you could tell, especially in the context of organizational change or learning and development, where would you want the L&D and change executives to start? What would be the ideal process that you would have them think about at a high level about how to craft solutions that are deliberate, intentional, and holistic for business results, not just activity results?
Well, that's kind of a tough one because I guess the place to start is with the leadership of the enterprise. And, you know, whether you're sitting at the table or in the row off the table, but listening in like the fly on the wall to understand what are the challenges of the organization that you're there to support. You know, L&D, training and development, is a support organization. We're not the king of the hill. We don't have the most impact on anybody else. We are there to support people learning and mastering how to do their jobs. And if we're aligned with our leadership, we know where we are, we know where we're going, we know about mid-course corrections a day and a half after some big decision was made. We're in constant alignment. We have to do continuous improvement of our alignment to the organization, and we need to look for the key leverage points. I think one of the things with e-learning and that is that we're treating everybody as if they were equal, of equal impact. So we're willing to make equal investments to everybody on their learning and development, when I don't think any organization can afford to do that. They need to strategically pick what job titles, what functions, what processes are absolutely critical and could sink the ship. And so how do we address those? We have to have our priorities set. We have to know what is our first tier priorities from processes and the people within them. We need to know what the second and third tier are because we certainly can't afford everything. No one can. And therefore, we need to be judicious in terms of our targeting of who we're trying to affect with our learning products and services. So, you know, so I think you got to start with that. You know, what are we aligned? Do we really know what we were working on? And are we being held accountable for our impact or not to those critical target audiences and the critical targeted processes or workflows? So I think that that's where you got to start. Then, of course, you know, once you're in alignment, so it's kind of a two-part answer, I guess. So you've got to be in total alignment and continuously realigning as necessary, as driven by the business and the direction and the things that come up. And then do we have sufficient, as an L&D practice area, do we have our own processes, our own practices, our own infrastructure, our own people at the ready to meet all challenges? Yes or no is the answer. So leadership of L&D needs to be looking at, so am I in alignment? Do I understand what I should be working on? Do I know which projects I currently am doing that I need to drop today to go tackle these other things because they are more critical? Can I be nimble? Can we do that? And do I have processes that approach the analysis of need, the design to meet the need, the development? Do I have that to operate as effectively and efficiently as possible? Is it quick? Is it darn quick? And does it produce quality? And can I afford to put out a product that kind of gets at it but doesn't really get at it, but we'll do continuous improvement over time? Well, that could be life or death for certain processes and such. So there's a time and a place for that. There's a time and a place to put out a product that is kind of close but not quite what we need, but we're going to put it out there anyway and see what happens. Well, there's a time and place for that, but that's usually for things that aren't of critical nature where we absolutely have to get it as right as possible. And maybe we can tolerate some imperfections because life is like that. Or where do we need to have, you know, closer to perfection than not? And the leadership can tell us and guide us with that. And they should hold us accountable. So too often we're not aligned close enough with them. We're, you know, the stepchildren, so to speak, and we're, you know, we're not given the credence, and it's because of our own past practices, the sins of our past collectively, have affected how leaders and organizations feel about us as a function, as a practice area, and what we can do for them. We too often produce, you know, topics, and we get a lot of attendance, and we got a lot of butts in seats, and we got a lot of completions, but we don't have, seem to have any impact. Yeah, so when budgets get cut, we get cut. Yeah. Well, if you haven't gotten yourself to where you are critically an enabler of business processes, you won't be cut if you are seen as that, and you have to prove yourself by having an impact to the business measures. So I'm sorry, that's a long answer, but so to start, get aligned and get competent as an entity. Be confident in what you're doing and darn quick about it, and be aligned and be nimble to change with the changing conditions that the business faces. Yeah.
Guy, I don't think you should feel sorry about that. I think that was a phenomenal answer, and it really went to the heart of the matter about how to make training and development supportive of business success.
Absolutely.
I think that's brilliant. Thank you so much.
You know, and once again, what I'm hearing is evidence-based performance absolutely tells us that effective and efficient L&D is quite deliberate, intentional, holistic, and strategic in its approach. And I think that's a very important statement right there. And Guy, I know we briefly touched on this point, but I just want to pick your brain just a little bit further and share this with our listeners because, number one, it is such a critical idea. And number two, I think there's room for improvement in this area in the field of ERP organizational change. But what role exactly does effective transfer of knowledge play in effective learning? And I know that's a bit generally, intentionally, kind of a generic statement or question rather, but what would you say to that? What role exactly does effective transfer of knowledge play in effective training?
Well, it's critical. It's as if you created a brand new whiz-bang thing to make your mechanical processes work much more efficiently, but you never installed it. Or you ship it out there sitting next to the machinery and nobody installed it. So what good was that investment? So
exactly.
I think transfer is really critical. And in the last couple of books that I've been writing, I've got one in process, but I talk about when I meet with my clients and I craft a project plan and I review it with them so that they can handpick the people I'm going to work with, because that's a secret to success, I think. I bring up transfer.
Exactly.
So I always ask, so you want to do this thing, here's the scope, as I understand it, here's how I'm going to conduct your project, here's where the milestones are, blah, 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 here's the cost. How are you going to affect transfer? What are the transfer issues? What's going to inhibit this from transferring? I mean, we can train them, and they can go back to the job, and their supervisor might say, Guy, I don't understand this newfangled way you're doing it. Do it my way. I can manage that. Or will it be the peers that say that? Or will it simply be not as easy as it was taught to apply this in the performance context? So what are those issues? And I bring this up at the end of phase 1 project planning and kickoff. I bring it up at the phase 2 gate review meeting. Let's look at the analysis data. Oh, yeah, before we disband, what about transfer? And so I hit my clients deliberately at every stage that I can to bring up transfer because I want them thinking about it. In fact, I've had clients where, you know, in the heat of the moment, I forgot about it and then went to close the meeting and somebody said, well, what about transfer? And I thought, yes. So And I don't push them to figure it all out until we know exactly what we've got. You know, we design it, we develop it, we pilot test it, a full destructive test, break it if we can, see what needs to be fixed before we are worried about revising it and releasing it into the system so that deploy or make it accessible. But near the end there, we've got to actually think about, so what do we give the supervisor? Now, I've had a couple of clients. It was actually a group at Amoco, and then they went to Eli Lilly back in the 90s, and they did not allow a vendor to produce a training package for a target audience without including something for the supervisors, something before they kind of bookended. So there was something for the supervisor to inform Guy, we're sending you to training. Here's why. Here's what you're going to do when you come back. Pay attention. And then I'd go take the training. And then there was something for the supervisor when Guy got back from training. So the supervisors could say, here's what we're going to do. You're going to apply this here, there, or whatever, and I'm going to give you some feedback. So we sandwiched, we bookmarked the instruction, the learning, and got the supervisor involved. Now, what Guy could say when he got to the class, because this was the old days, right? Or we could do this online, too, with e-learning. We could say, hey, the supervisor never mentioned a darn thing. Okay, good for management to know. Because one of the things that Guy would have said to the project steering team, the stakeholders, the vice presidents of sales or marketing or manufacturing or whatever, is that, hey, your supervisors aren't telling Guy and the other learners why they're going in the first place. They're not establishing the expectations of what this is all about and why it's important.
Right.
And then when they get back, they're not doing anything. We're asking in our post, you know, afterwards, the evaluations that we do, that the supervisor didn't do what they were supposed to do. Well, that's on management. That's on the stakeholders here. You wanted this project done because it was critically important, yet you've not put all the pieces in place. You've provided people with some instruction, but you haven't paved the path. And you've not done the follow-up and evaluation, and there's more to it than Guy having learned something. It's about the supervisor and the peers, perhaps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what needs to be put in place to deal with transfer? Because if you don't put all the pieces in place, or from a Pareto perspective, 20% that's going to have 80% impact, then it may be a totally wasted investment from that point on, simply because, you know, you didn't have a horseshoe nail for the horse, and the battle was lost, and the war was lost, and the kingdom was lost, and all for the want of a horseshoe nail.
I'm loving the analogies here. Guy, based on this whole conversation, I'm really curious to get your thoughts. How do you know exactly in terms of effectiveness and efficiency when we're doing change and training as a part of that, that we're going to get the time, money, effort required as inputs to really make a difference to a meaningful business ROI?
Well, that's tricky because there's more moving parts when you're doing changes. There's more changing moving parts than just the instructional element. So you may not be able to prove to the CFO's satisfaction that this was your percentage of the impact and improvement and ROI. But that's less important is whether the leaders involved in the change initiative and their clients, the executive leadership team, if you will, if they understand that we taught people to do things. Now, we may have asked them to implement a faulty process, and we didn't figure that out until after we implemented it. So that's not the fault of the training organization or learning organization, that the process was faulty, or that we bought some new software and put it in place, but it actually didn't really get the job done either. So there's more variables than that, but all we can do is be a team player. All we can do is we need to be involved in the planning of these change initiatives so that we understand and can see where the information will be solid enough for us to begin development of content after analysis, after design, and start developing. And knowing that some things are subject to change and being nimble, having the resources on our work stream, if you will, so that we can support the other work streams, and when it all comes together for some sort of a initial testing or the rollout, that we've done our due diligence and we've done the best that we can. Again, some things can be taught and just be, you know, pretty well on target, and we'll do continuous improvement to them. Other things are less forgiving, and so we need to work in concert with the other people working on the other work streams in the huge change initiative. So it's being aligned with the customers, being aligned with your project, with the overall initiative, and that requires a lot of communications across all the various work streams and understanding, you know, what issues Workstream A is having. And if I'm Workstream D, I got to know what the impact of A is on B and C, and therefore on me, because I'm the tail, not the dog. And so I've got to understand, you know, what is it that I'm supporting and what's going on and changing and what's stable and what's not, knowing that whatever I know for sure may not be for sure tomorrow. And so I've got to have flexible processes, quick and nimble processes that will produce the instructional content that will provide people what they need. Now, this kind of goes back then to is that new performance contest going to demand a memorized response? One huge issue that we make all too often, because our clients love it this way, is that, you know, we try to have people memorize everything and they can't. So what can we provide them with? Job aids or performance support is what's called nowadays. It's kind of a less formal SOP, standard operating procedure. But can we provide them guidance so they can refer to that? And maybe they'll master it the 12th time they've used it and they won't need that anymore. And so what kinds of supports can we put in place here and make it available in the workflow, as it's called nowadays, so that it's less disruptive for them to turn, refer to something, and then do it with that kind of guidance? Now, these notions have been around with us for decades, but in my first job, I was told on day one, hey, we're going to do more of this thing called guidance. It's what Rumler and Gilbert called it, and then it became more popularly known as job aids. But so we're going to do this guidance thing. We're going to default to guidance, and we'll do training, you know, if it's absolutely necessary. Well, our clients hated that. So what we did is sneaky trick number 87. We embedded job aids into the training so that people would be able to go, oh, here, I'll take this and mimeograph this back at the store, and they'll have their own job aids, and they wouldn't have been forced to memorize something. What we want to do is we're going to test people. Can they take the reference guides that we give them and then do the job? But there are certain situations out there where a memorized response is demanded by the performance context. All the time or just some of the time? And just some of the time is the worst case scenario. So a guy could reference things, but there's other times when, no, there's going to be a time, it's going to be rare, but it's going to happen. He's going to have that committed to memory. Otherwise, everything goes to heck. All right. Yeah. So now we got to teach him this. And because of the forgetting curve, we're going to have to do spaced learning and reinforce that from all time out. It's why fire departments practice firefighting all the time. It's why the Army practices its maneuvers all the time, because people are going to forget things. And if it's that critical, then you can't allow them to forget it, which is a human condition, which is unavoidable unless you augment the situation with the kinds of prompts that keep these things to whatever level is required.
Guy, what a fun conversation. I wish we had 2 or 3 hours to chat and have you share your insight with our listeners. So I think since we don't have 2 to 3 hours, we certainly would like to have you back again, because we have lots of stuff we'd like to chat with you about and share with our listeners. But lastly, Guy, this is our favorite question. I know Jonathan loves this question, and so do I. But if you were to distill down your years of experience, your expertise, your research, what would be your closing remarks that you would like to leave with our listeners in terms of effective L&D in general?
Okay, yeah, here it is. Focus on the terminal performance requirements from back on the job and enable them, whether that requires instruction or not. Help the client see that. Focus on those terminal performance requirements and help enable them. And that may simply be helping your clients see that there's other interventions that they need to put in place, and maybe they don't need any training, instruction, or learning at all, and you will have done a good thing for your enterprise.
That is powerful advice, very powerful advice. So thank you for that. You know, Guy, I often say, I guess my personal view based on professional experience, you know, what we do in ERP organizational change is 25% IT, you know, it's systems and infrastructure, of course, and applications, 25% business, often in the form of business process reengineering and maybe, you know, reallocation of internal resources and that sort of thing. But I still believe that 50% of our field is L&D, it's learning and development, and it's education, i.e. organizational learning. So your insight, what you bring to the table, and what we can learn as ERP practitioners from you and your work and your expertise is incredibly valuable. So thanks for that. And again, for our listeners, please check out HPT Treasures, such a great resource for evidence-based performance improvement. I highly recommend that you check that out. So, Guy, thank you so much for your time today. Keep up the good work, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. You're welcome.
Wow, Jack, that was an amazing conversation.
It sure was, Jonathan. So much fun.
Listeners, thank you for joining us on today's episode. We are incredibly excited and grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us on our podcast. We have an incredible lineup of guests, including ERP and organizational change speakers, authors, professors, researchers, pioneers in the field, practitioners, PE partners, business executives, ERP vendors, and organizational stakeholders. We invite you to leave us feedback and a review because we want to make this the most useful and insightful podcast you listen to, and we need your help to do so.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us again this week as we seek to, one, promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community, two, contribute to the field of ERP organizational change, and three, bring research and practice closer together. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. Our podcast will draw on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience.
From everyone here on the team, Jack, and myself, we wish you a great week, and we hope to see you again soon on another episode.
Hashtag the ERP Organizational Change Journal. Have a fantastic week.
Bye for now.